now in session.
Thank you. You may be seated. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Today we have one case set for oral argument, and I know that the lawyers have checked in. And before we get started, I'll introduce the panel. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right, Justice Mike Wallach. I'm Elizabeth Kerr. And unless there's any reason not to, I'll ask the clerk to go ahead and call the case.
The court will now call number 02-24-193-CR, Clinton Renfro versus the state of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Niles Gillick will argue for the appellate, and Mr. Matthew Whitman will argue for the state.
Okay. You may proceed, Mr. Gillick.
May it please the court, my name is Niles Illick and I represent the appellant. Before I begin, I want to thank the court for the opportunity to be here. This was asked, oral argument was requested and under unusual circumstances to give my first year associate an opportunity to argue a very narrow issue, but she took a job that I couldn't afford to match the salary for, so she's not here and you get me instead.
We always welcome seeing you, Mr.
Well, thank you, Chief Justice Kerr. Justice Kerr. So we're here this afternoon on a single issue, and that single issue I think is fairly discreet, and that is whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in failing to order an evidentiary hearing on the motion for new trial. Our contention is pretty straightforward, and it's laid out in the brief, that our client met the requirements for an evidentiary hearing. He timely filed his motion for a new trial. I don't think there's any dispute about that.
How was it presented?
It was presented to the judge and a presentment order was signed by the judge.
Okay, I didn't pour deep into the record and I don't know. Yeah.
On this case, there's not a lot of need to, but yeah. You'll find that I think at page 513 or 514 and it's signed by the judge. So I think that's our second point, that we clearly meet the requirement for presentment. And I don't think counsel over here is going to legitimately dispute that. The motion is supported by an affidavit signed by counsel, signed by trial counsel. Counsel filed the affidavit. And I think the real dispute is whether or not, two issues perhaps, but the issues were not resolvable on the record by themselves.
Let me stop you real quick there and just ask you, is there case law that really, I guess you could say, specifically defines what determinable from the record means?
You know, Justice Walker, I wish there was a better case on that, and maybe this is a really, you know, a silver lining is that you could do that in this case, and this is a good case for that because I think we have a bunch of unpublished cases on this. You know, the cases like this rarely get published, and I am unaware of a precedential opinion from this court that says, here's when we're going to say it's determinable on the record, and here's when it's not.
Yeah.
This case, I would suggest to the court, is a little bit different than most because, as counsel for the state argues, there's a question about whether or not my client came to the court and said true or not true to the allegations against him. And so, in a moment of embarrassing candor, that's not something I thought about when I wrote this brief, but as I read counsel's opposing brief, that seems to me to be a very compelling reason why they needed to go forward and have the evidentiary hearing.
Well, I mean, did trial counsel have any responsibility, you know, because on the final order, you know, there was the true or not true for the judge to circle or cross out one of them, and it was just left unchosen.
Yes, Justice Kerr, and I obviously trial counsel had some responsibility to do that, and it would have been, everyone in this room agrees it would have been preferable for him to do that. The remedy for that, however, I think can be done in a motion for a new trial. I don't think that's a time when we can clear up and clarify the record before it comes to you all so that we have some clarity and some certainty in that. And the affidavit from counsel says that that my client pled not true.
And that's the only thing in the whole record, as far as I could see, where that was asserted.
Well, yes. Are you talking about it in the affidavit?
Yes, in the affidavit.
I think you could see at pages 238 and 239 of volume 4, you could see discussion that sort of tinges around that, right?
Yeah. I might not agree with you on that, because I was going to ask, that sort of leads into the other question I had about the affidavit, where trial counsel says affirmatively the court would not bifurcate the proceeding between adjudication and punishment. That makes it sound like the trial court was affirmatively asked to do that and said no. And I understand your position that you can kind of read between the lines on page 238, but trial counsel, I don't interpret that necessarily as, I mean, it seemed like he was like, okay, then he won't testify.
Justice Kerr, this is I can't disagree with that, and I think it's exactly why we needed an evidentiary hearing. So you go up there, you tell the judge, Judge, we're here because we ask you to bifurcate, and you wouldn't do it. And the judge, you know, is going to say, hey, you didn't ask me that. That's not at all what we talked about. And the state can get up and say that. They're not really acting as witnesses, but they're filling out the details of the people who were there.
Well, are we allowed to draw any sort of inference that by the trial court's just letting this motion for a new trial get overruled by operation of law that the trial court remembered? You know, you didn't ask for that.
Well, Justice Kerr, I don't know that I mean, the court can make a reasonable inference. I don't think that the conclusion comes from the premises. Because it wasn't signed and because the judge was there, does that mean he remembered this and that? Well, maybe it was, but maybe it wasn't. There are other possible reasons for that. And with the presence of other possible reasons, I don't think we can get from the premises. It's a reasonable, you know, going like Hooper, right? Reasonable deduction, but it doesn't mean we can conclude that. So I don't think we get there. This is the case where we needed the evidentiary hearing.
Well, okay. If you had had the evidentiary hearing, and I didn't see anything in the affidavit or the new trial motion that really laid out what the odds were for a different outcome. I mean, he didn't even get sentenced to the full 180 days. And the state, you know, the state argues that could have gone worse.
But
how do we know that the outcome might have been different?
Yeah, and Justice Kerr, this is always the hardest part for me to get up here and talk to you about harm and about prejudice, because I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell you what would have happened, but I think we can look at it in two respects. The first is to say that I think we can all agree that when a defendant gets up and testifies, it is often the most compelling evidence. But that can be for him, and that can be against him. It can hurt him significantly. Clients get up and say just the most remarkable things that probably made their sentence a longer sentence than it would have been. So it's very difficult for me to get beyond that. But I would say that it was his constitutional right to have that option, and that the judge took that constitutional right away from him by refusing to recognize the right, the necessity of bifurcating. Please go ahead.
Well, I just come back to the fact that from the reporter's record, there was nothing in there that speaks to me as there having been a defense request to bifurcate. Because, I mean, let me maybe this is a way to segue. I'm interested in your response to the state's position that that the evidence that he would have wanted to present in, you know, it's like, this was my mental state at the time, this is what I was thinking, I felt like I had to do this to see my children. I mean, the state's position is that came in through other witnesses.
And Justice Kerr, certainly it did come in to some degree through other witnesses, but I do not think it had the same compelling, the same important. It's hard to believe that this man did this because he wanted to see his children. That didn't come across to me in the record, and that's just, you know, my candor to you on that. But if he had gotten up and communicated that to the court directly and talked to the court about how this was important, that he was doing this for this reason. And we're not talking about necessity defense. We're talking about mitigation. Get up there. Yes.
Well, so does it matter that trial counsel on page 9 of the fourth volume, because the state's saying, hey, defense counsel can't elicit any testimony that, that he didn't have capacity or the mens rea because of his mental health. And trial counsel said, no argument on that.
But I think that goes to guilt and innocence, doesn't it? I think it doesn't go as much to mitigation. To get up and say, judge, this is why I accept your finding of true. This is why I did it. Now, you may not agree with it, but I'm telling you this is why I did it. And that doesn't negate the mens rea. It doesn't get him off the hook. But it does come in and say, judge, you know, you could see this as me just stalking my ex. You could see it that way. But I want you to know why I'm so concerned about these kids. I want you to know why I did this. And that would be different. So I think their point on the mens rea really goes to guilt and innocence, whether or not it's true or not true, and much less to mitigation.
Let me ask you a question, and it's almost rhetorical in nature because I think I know the answer. And I get that this is a kind of a nuanced, rare occasion where a defense counsel asks essentially to let the client testify for one of the phases but not the other. I'm sure there's not a ton of case law on it because of that. But is there any case law out there that says in the instance where defense counsel asks specifically for his client to be able to testify to punishment as opposed to guilt and innocence or vice versa, that the trial court has a sua sponte duty to then bifurcate, essentially? If they say, no, I'm not going to let you do that, I'm not going to let you have your cake and eat it too, then they have a sua sponte duty to say, well, but I will let you bifurcate, or I need to let you bifurcate, because you do have a point that if I don't bifurcate, I'm infringing on your Fifth Amendment rights.
And Justice Walker, I hope I'm not talking in circles when I answer this, but I think the answer to this is that however the trial court structures it, they must ultimately give that defendant the opportunity to make that mitigation argument for himself, to speak in mitigation. I don't necessarily know how you would do that without bifurcating. You could kind of have an informal bifurcation. You could kind of have an agreement between the attorneys. But ultimately, in the end, there's got to be something there. And I think the case law, both in the state's brief and in my brief, will direct the court to precedent that says the trial court must provide that opportunity. And it's that opportunity that really matters, whether you call it unitary or bifurcated, or you do it, you know, often things in the trial court are done sort of in a more casual way than you know, formally saying, okay, we're bifurcating, we're doing it here, and they get it done, and it's a convenient way to do it. But I think they could do it that way as long as that opportunity is provided. Does that answer your question? And I think the cases, I think, are both in the state's brief and in my brief, and I don't think you'll find a disagreement between us. The disagreement, I think, will be about whether or not the trial court provided that opportunity. It's our contention that they didn't. They, of course, contend that they did.
Got it.
All right. If there are no further questions, I will yield the balance of my time to the court. And again, thank you for the opportunity to be here under these different circumstances.
Thank you very much. Mr. Whitten.
May it please the court. I would also like to say thank you for the opportunity to present our cases here today. It is an unusual circumstance. I asked for oral argument to meet board certification requirements, and then on a closer reread of the board certification requirements, I already have enough oral arguments.
Gosh, y'all could have called.
I may not sound like that today. We'll see. But I do want to thank you for your time. As Mr. Illich said, I think this case is pretty well briefed. I do want to touch on a couple of things that I think could be a little clearer. The preservation issue in particular, why the state's contention is that the Issa case, the Viadura case that Mr. Renfro relies on are distinguishable here. Why a unitary proceeding was okay here, and on the motion for new trial, and why no hearing on the motion for new trial was necessary. I'm sorry, the adjudication unitary hearing was okay. we are asking the court to hold that the error was not preserved. That's kind of a twofold thing. The first part of that is there is nothing in the record about how Mr. Renfro pled on the MTAG, other than his statement attached to his motion, his attorney's statement attached to his motion for new trial. Now, there's no requirement in an adjudication proceeding for a plea necessarily, but that's, it's critically important here in terms of preservation, the apparent lack of one. It's not necessary whether you infer some kind of plea one way or the other. I do think it's reasonable to read the record of this hearing and say that Mr. Renfro's focus was on mitigation defenses, particularly those defenses relating to his anxiety, his obsession over being able to see his children.
So who has the burden to request a bifurcation?
That would be on Mr. Renfro. The reason being, if he's pleading not true, it's probably the case that a bifurcated proceeding could be more appropriate if he's trying to present separate mitigation evidence. But here,
is there any case law as to when a bifurcation has to be requested?
That's an interesting question. Presumably, this kind of goes to what Justice Wallach was asking. Is it on the court to say, oh gosh, well maybe I can go ahead and adjudicate you right now, and then we'll have a proceeding on mitigation. But in this case, it never came up. The entire thrust of Mr. Renfro's cross-examinations and his own witnesses were about this issue that he then brought up in the motion for new trial.
Let me ask this though. I mean, if I don't try to put myself in the trial judge's shoes, but trial judges who do criminal law and handle adjudications frequently, I would just think that in this instance, when the trial judge was asked what he specifically was asked, that he would immediately think, you know, I could bifurcate this, and then you would have that right, but I'm not going to do it, you know, but I'm not going to talk about it either. Because you haven't specifically asked for that.
Well, I think that the way in which it may have gotten brought up, if you read the record, seems to be, well, I want to put my client on the stand to testify about this one thing and not another, but there's no objection to a unitary proceeding being had. There was never an objection to it. And I think it's reasonable to think that on this record, that the trial court, she thought, well, we're proceeding on mitigation defenses here.
So there's no rules or case law that says when or how a bifurcation has to be requested?
No, and I think that's how ISSA and Volturi are somewhat distinguishable. In those cases, the trial court never gave an opportunity at all for mitigation defenses to be presented, and moreover, the holding in that ISSA case was, because the defendant's request to present punishment evidence were denied, and he was denied the opportunity to even object at the time of sentencing, he was permitted to raise those for the first time in a motion for a new trial. But that's not what happened here.
To me, this case is more like the facts of Grammar.
Yes.
I'm just looking at this passage here from the CCA opinion. Immediately after the party, and it was a revocation or adjudication proceeding, immediately after the parties finished their closing arguments, the trial court adjudicated appellant's guilt and sentenced him. Neither appellant nor his lawyer objected that appellant was being denied, quote, a separate punishment hearing, or that he was being denied an opportunity to present punishment evidence. So that suggests to me that you know, you can wait as late as that, but you still need to say something.
That's correct, and that's essentially what our argument is here today in that regard. Even if you assume, I think, a plea of not true, without that record evidence, the record does reflect that Mr. Renfro had that opportunity to present mitigating punishment evidence at the hearing, and so it's hard to say, well, he was prevented from even objecting. He was prevented from even trying.
In Denton County, you know, is it irrespective of the rules that are on point or the lack of rules that are on point, in practice, is it seem that typical revocation hearings by default are unitary? I think in other places they are. Most places they are. Is it that way in Denton County?
I cannot answer that question because I practice in the appellate building across the street mostly. But sure. I will say that I don't think it's unusual. The ones I've read, it is not unusual. What is unusual would be maybe that happening when there is a specific not true plea and actual contentions that, hey, I didn't show, for like in this case, I didn't show up at my ex-wife's house. That kind of leads me into another question you asked.
Well, and before you go there, okay. I'll just throw this out there for rhetoric, but that I from what you see in your appellate job at the DA's office, a greater proportion and a higher percentage of revocations are typically pleas of true, and they're just trying to get it's a true but, as we call mm-hmm. them. You're pleading true, but you're asking, you disagree with the DA on the sentence, so you're asking for a sentence.
Yes, I mean, the dispute in most of these is, can I stay on probation or do I have to go to jail?
Yeah.
That's typical of what it is.
Well, yeah, because if Mr. Renfro had pleaded not true, I didn't see a whole lot of evidence in the record of his trial counsel pushing back on the underlying facts for the revocation.
I think that's correct. And if you look at that leads into a question he asked counsel and you asked, which is what evidence is there that a necessity type defense or some evidence of his intent would have been important. If you look at the last two allegations in the second amended in tag and the way that the bond conditions are written, intent is not something we had to prove in terms of his showing up at his wife's house. The bond condition was, and the MTAG allegation was, he showed up at his wife's house. His reasons for doing so aren't necessarily even relevant to the guilt-innocence phase. And so when you ask the question, can we know what is determinable from the record, I think anything that would have been relevant to his revocation, especially on those two allegations in the MTAG, can be determined from the record and are also not the kind of issues that are likely to lead to any kind of different result.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a difference between determinable and, I guess, seen from the record or found in the record.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the word determinable means that it's something you see in the record, but a determination can be made on those items. But you still think that would be present here.
Yes, I think that neither prong is satisfied in terms of when would a hearing be necessary. Even if we ignore those preservation issues, neither of those prongs are satisfied based on the counsel's affidavit or what they're trying to raise and the thrust of what was already in the hearing. It's all cumulative of what was already there. That would be the position we would take. If there are no, oh.
So how is the trial judge supposed to manage the proceeding if he or she doesn't have a true or not true plea and no motion to bifurcate? Because they don't know the scope of what you're dealing with is, do you?
Well, I think that at some point it can become clear what the defensive issues are. And on the record we have in this case, the defensive issues were in mitigation. They were about Mr. Renfro's anxiety.
It just seems if for example, if we're going to draw a line on what should be done from a standpoint of orderly procedure, a motion to bifurcate ought to be made before the proceeding starts, it seems to me.
Well, I would agree with that, especially in a sense if you're pleading not true.
And no one knows better whether they're going to call their client than the lawyer who represents the defendant.
I think that's correct. I don't know how that would interplay with the general principle that no plea is necessary in an MTAG, but I think once it becomes clear what those defensive issues are, maybe there is a need for the person who's going to plead not true to say, I plead not true, or at least to make that motion to bifurcate.
If the state is concerned from a policy perspective about due process rights, and there's a lack of a plea in a revocation case, we know that obviously the state's going to have to prove that it's revocable. And by default, in other words, they're going to have to put on some kind of proof that there was some kind of violation in the conditions of the probation.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, they're also going to have to prove, for purposes of punishment, what the appropriate punishment is and why. If due process is a concern, one might just as easily argue an opposite, you know, playing the devil's advocate, that if there's no plea, one, you should make the revocation be proven, and two, by default, it should be bifurcated, that you shouldn't do it unitary, that you should just automatically, by default, the courts should have two parts to the process.
I think that having two parts may be the default, but on this record, what we do know tells us that the state did set out to prove those allegations, and that the cross-examinations and Mr. Renfro's evidence were all in mitigation of it. Whether he showed up to his wife's house or not was not really in dispute, whether he pled true or not true. And so a due process issue here didn't really present itself in that sense. I don't know if we can form a bright line rule about when should a motion to bifurcate be made, or should that even be required, certainly not based on this record. Well, I want to thank you for your time. Thank you for hearing our case, and we just ask that this court affirm the trial court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Very quickly. I think what we've heard from both sides today is that there's a lot of uncertainty around this area of law, and it's easy to take a case like this where we've got pretty small, discrete issue and issue a memorandum opinion and be done with it. And I've worked for the first Court of Appeals. I understand the work that you all have. But it's also an opportunity. And whether the court goes with me or goes with the state, it's an opportunity to help the judges in Denton County who are, I think, treating cases, and in Dallas, all over, they're treating them as unitary without a whole lot of thought about whether or not it belongs.
Well, do you think that the record in this case provides a really solid vehicle for us to try to draw those sorts of lines?
I think it at least offers the opportunity for that discussion to begin, and I think it does provide a really good opportunity for a discussion about when an evidentiary hearing is required. What is waiver in a situation look like in a case like this? Typically these issues are just glossed over, both at the trial court and, frankly, in the 14 appellate courts. We don't get into these issues very often, but it's something that comes up a lot, and across the state we could use direction on that.
And if default is a bifurcated two hearings, then it doesn't matter. If there was a lack of objection, obviously, because that's just the way it's supposed to be done, and it's not necessarily being done that way.
Yes, Justice Walker, and I think that's a terrific point. I think you're probably right. Counsel, of course, disagrees with you, and no one here knows the answer to it. And that's exactly why I think this is an opportunity for the court to, even if they can't, I don't know how many counties you all cover, but it's
12.
12. I mean, it's quite a lot of the state of Texas. It's a lot of people without direction on this. It's not your fault. It's not anybody's fault, but it is an opportunity. And
this is something the legislature, I guess, could take up, couldn't it?
Sure. And I have a list of things I'd love for them to address, and they haven't done so. But anyway, listen, I thank the court for the opportunity. I know this is an unusual case, and you all were generous with your time.
I think you both should go down there and testify on the before the committee.
And I'd like you to be there. I think it makes sense. We can tell them fix that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you both for the oral argument. Appreciate you making the drive down here under these circumstances. And with that, your case is submitted, and we will stand adjourned.
Thank you. All rise.